Random House Audio presents The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America by Eric Larson. Read for you by Tony Goldwyn. Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood. Daniel H. Burnham, Director of Works, World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. Dr. H. H. Holmes, Confession, 1896. The date was April 14, 1912, a sinister day in maritime history. But of course, the man in Suite 63-65, Shelter Deck C, did not yet know it. What he did know was that his foot hurt badly, more than he had expected. He was 65 years old and had become a large man. His hair had turned gray, his mustache nearly white, but his eyes were as blue as ever, bluer at this instant by proximity to the sea. His foot had forced him to delay the voyage, and now it kept him anchored in his suite while the other first-class passengers, his wife among them, did what he would have loved to do, which is explore the ship's more exotic precincts. The man was Daniel Hudson Burnham, and by now his name was familiar throughout the world. He was an architect and had done his work pretty well in Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Manila, and many other cities. He and his wife Margaret were sailing to Europe in the company of their daughter and her husband for a grand tour that was to continue through the summer. Burnham had chosen this ship, the RMS Olympic of the White Star Line, because it was new and glamorous and big. At the time he booked passage, the Olympic was the largest vessel in regular service, but just 2 days before his departure, a sister ship, a slightly longer twin, had stolen that rank when it set off on its maiden voyage. The twin, Burnham knew, was at that moment carrying one of his closest friends, the painter Francis Millet, over the same ocean but in the opposite direction. As the last sunlight of the day entered Burnham's suite, he and Margaret set off for the first-class dining room on the deck below. They took the elevator to spare his foot the torment of the grand stairway, but he did so with reluctance, for he admired the artistry in the iron scrollwork of its balustrades and the immense dome of iron and glass that flushed the ship's core with natural light. His sore foot had placed increasing limitations on his mobility. Only a week earlier, he had found himself in the humiliating position of having to ride in a wheelchair through Union Station in Washington, D.C., the station he had designed. The Burnhams dined by themselves in the Olympic's first-class salon, then retired to their suite, and there, for no particular reason, Burnham's thoughts returned to Frank Millet. On impulse, he resolved to send Millet a mid-sea greeting via the Olympic's powerful Marconi wireless. Burnham signaled for a steward. A middle-aged man in knife-edged whites took his message up three decks to the Marconi room adjacent to the officer's promenade. He returned a few moments later, the message still in his hand, and told Burnham the operator had refused to accept it. Foot sore and irritable, Burnham demanded that the steward return to the wireless room for an explanation. Millet was never far from Burnham's mind, nor was the event that had brought the two of them together, the great Chicago World's Fair of 1893. Millet had been one of Burnham's closest allies in the long, bittersweet struggle to build the fair. Its official name was the World's Columbian Exposition, its official purpose to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. But under Burnham, its chief builder, it had become something enchanting, known throughout the world as the White City. It had lasted just 6 months, yet during that time, its gatekeepers recorded 27.5 million visits. This when the country's total population was 65 million. On its best day, the fair drew over 700,000 visitors. That the fair had occurred at all, however, was something of a miracle. To build it, Burnham confronted a legion of obstacles, any one of which could have, should have, killed it long before opening day. Together, he and his architects conjured a dream city whose grandeur and beauty exceeded anything each singly could have imagined. Visitors wore their best clothes and most somber expressions, as if entering a great cathedral. Some wept at its beauty. They tasted a new snack called Cracker Jack and a new breakfast food called shredded wheat. Whole villages had been imported from Egypt, Algeria, Dahomey, and other far-flung locales, along with their inhabitants. Everything about the fair was exotic, and above all, immense. The fair occupied more than 1 square mile and filled over 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall was large enough to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral all at the same time. One structure, rejected at first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem. A machine so huge and terrifying, it instantly eclipsed the tower of Alexandre Eiffel that had so wounded America's pride. Never before had so many of history's brightest lights, including Buffalo Bill, Theodore Dreiser, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Thomas Edison, Henry Adams, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, Nikola Tesla, Ignaz Paderewski, Philip Armour, Marshall Field, gathered in one place at one time. Richard Harding Davis called the exposition the greatest event in the history of the country since the Civil War. That something magical had occurred in that summer of the World's Fair was beyond doubt, but darkness, too, had touched the fair. Scores of workers had been hurt or killed in building the dream, their families consigned to poverty. There was the fire that killed 15 more, and the assassin who transformed the closing ceremony from what was to have been the century's greatest celebration into a vast funeral. Worse had occurred, although these revelations emerged only slowly. A murderer had moved among the beautiful things Burnham had created. Young women, drawn to Chicago by the fair and by the prospect of living on their own, had disappeared. Last seen at the killer's block-long mansion, a parody of everything architects held dear. It was only after the exposition that Burnham and his colleagues learned of the anguished letters to Chicago's police describing daughters who had come to the city and then fallen silent. The press speculated that scores of fairgoers must have disappeared within the building. Even the street-hardened members of the city's White Chapel Club, named for the London stalking grounds of Jack the Ripper, were startled by what detectives eventually found inside and by the fact that such grisly events could have gone undiscovered for so long. The rational explanation laid blame on the forces of change that during this time had convulsed Chicago. Amid so much turmoil, it was understandable that the work of a young and handsome doctor would go unnoticed. As time passed, however, even sober men and women began to think of him in less than rational terms. He described himself as the devil and contended that his physical shape had begun to alter. Enough strange things began happening to the men who brought him to justice to make his claim seem almost plausible. For the supernaturally inclined, just the death of the jury foreman offered sufficient proof. The ship's steward came back to Burnham. The expression in his eyes had changed. He apologized. He still could not send the message, he said, but at least now he had an explanation. An accident had occurred involving Millett's ship. In fact, he said, the Olympic was at that moment speeding north at maximum velocity to come to her aid, with instructions to receive and care for injured passengers. He knew nothing more. Burnham shifted his leg and winced, and waited for more news. He hoped that when the Olympic at last reached the site of the accident, he would find Millett and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. In the peace of his stateroom, Burnham opened his diary. That night, the fair came back to him with extra clarity. Chicago, 1890 to 1891. How easy it was to disappear. 1,000 trains a day entered or left Chicago. Many of these trains brought single young women who had never even seen a city, but now hoped to make one of the biggest and toughest their home. Jane Addams, the urban reformer who founded Chicago's Hull House, wrote, "Never before in civilization have such numbers of young girls been suddenly released from the protection of the home and permitted to walk unattended upon the city streets and to work under alien roofs." The women sought work as typists, stenographers, seamstresses, and weavers. The men who hired them were for the most part moral citizens intent on efficiency and profit, but not always. On March 30, 1890, an officer of the First National Bank placed a warning in the Help Wanted section of the Chicago Tribune to inform female stenographers of our growing conviction that no thoroughly honorable businessman who is this side of dotage ever advertises for a lady stenographer who is a blonde, is good-looking, is quite alone in the city, or will transmit her photograph. All such advertisements upon their face bear the marks of vulgarity, nor do we regard it as safe for any lady to answer such unseemly utterances. The women walked to work on streets that angled past bars, gambling houses, and bordellos. Vice thrived, with official indulgence. The parlors and bedrooms in which honest folk lived were, as now, rather dull places, wrote Ben Hecht late in his life, trying to explain this persistent trait of old Chicago. It was pleasant, in a way, to know that outside their windows the devil was still capering in a flare of brimstone. In an analogy that would prove all too apt, Max Weber likened the city to a human being with his skin removed. Anonymous death came early and often. Each of the 1,000 trains that entered and left the city did so at grade level. You could step from a curb and be killed by the Chicago Limited. Every day, on average, 2 people were destroyed at the city's rail crossings. Their injuries were grotesque. Pedestrians retrieved severed heads. There were other hazards. Streetcars fell from drawbridges. Horses bolted and dragged carriages into crowds. Fires took 12 lives a day. There was diphtheria, typhus, cholera, influenza. And there was murder. In the time of the fair, the rate at which men and women killed each other rose sharply throughout the nation, but especially in Chicago, where police found themselves without the manpower and expertise to manage the volume. In the first 6 months of 1892, the city experienced nearly 800 homicides, 4 a day. Most were prosaic, arising from robbery, argument, and sexual jealousy. Men shot women, women shot men, and children shot each other by accident. But all this could be understood. Nothing like the Whitechapel killings had occurred. Jack the Ripper's 5 murder spree in 1888 had defied explanation and captivated readers throughout America who believed such things could not happen in their own hometowns. Yet things were changing. Everywhere one looked, the boundary between moral and the wicked seemed to be degrading. Elizabeth Cady Stanton argued in favor of divorce. Victoria Woodhull advocated free love. A young woman named Borden killed her parents. And in Chicago, a young, handsome doctor stepped from a train, his surgical valise in hand. He entered a world of clamor, smoke, and steam, refulgent with the scents of murdered cattle and pigs. He found it to his liking. The letters came later, from the Segrands, Williamses, and Smythes, and untold others, addressed to that strange, gloomy castle at 63rd and Wallace, pleading for the whereabouts of daughters and daughters' children. It was so easy to disappear, so easy to deny knowledge, so very easy in the smoke and din to mask that something dark had taken root. This was Chicago, on the eve of the greatest fair in history. On the afternoon of Monday, February 24th, 1890, 2,000 people gathered on the sidewalk and street outside the offices of the Chicago Tribune, as other crowds collected at each of the city's 28 other daily newspapers, and in hotel lobbies, in bars, and at the offices of Western Union and the Postal Telegraph Company. The gathering outside the Tribune included businessmen, clerks, traveling salesmen, stenographers, police officers, and at least one barber. Messenger boys stood ready to bolt as soon as there was news worth reporting. The wait was electric, for Chicago was a prideful place. In every corner of the city, people looked into the faces of shopkeepers, cab drivers, waiters, and bellboys to see whether the news already had come and whether it was good or bad. So far, the year had been a fine one. Chicago's population had topped 1 million for the first time, making the city the second most populous in the nation after New York, although disgruntled residents of Philadelphia, previously in second place, were quick to point out that Chicago had cheated by annexing large expanses of land just in time for the 1890 decadal census. Chicago shrugged the sniping off. Big was big. Success today would dispel at last the Eastern perception that Chicago, was nothing more than a greedy, hog-slaughtering backwater. Failure would bring humiliation from which the city would not soon recover, given how heartily its leading men had boasted that Chicago would prevail. It was this big talk, not the persistent southwesterly breeze, that prompted New York editor Charles Henry Dana to nickname Chicago the Windy City. In their offices in the top floor of the Rookery, Daniel Burnham, 43, and his partner John Root, newly 40, felt the electricity more keenly than most. They were Chicago's leading architects. They had pioneered the erection of tall structures and designed the first building in the country ever to be called a skyscraper. Every year, it seemed, some new building of theirs became the tallest in the world. When they moved into the Rookery at LaSalle and Adams, a gorgeous light-filled structure of Root's design, they saw views of the lake and city that no one but construction workers had seen before. They knew, however, that today's events had the potential to make their success so far seem meager. The news would come by telegraph from Washington. The Tribune would get it from one of its own reporters. Its editors, rewrite men, and typesetters would compose extra editions as firemen shoveled coal into the boilers of the paper's steam-driven presses. A clerk would paste each incoming bulletin to a window face out for pedestrians to read. Even Burnham could not say for sure who had been the first to propose the idea. It had seemed to rise in many minds at once, the initial intent simply to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the New World by hosting a World's Fair. At first, the idea gained little momentum. Consumed by the great drive toward wealth and power that had begun after the end of the Civil War, America seemed to have scant interest in celebrating its distant past. In 1889, however, the French did something that startled everyone. In Paris, on the Champ de Mars, France opened the Exposition Universelle, a world's fair so big and glamorous, so exotic, that visitors came away believing no exposition could surpass it. At the heart of the exposition stood a tower of iron that rose 1,000 feet into the sky, higher by far than any man-made structure on Earth. The tower not only assured the eternal fame of its designer, Alexandre Gustave Eiffel, but also offered graphic proof that France had edged out the United States for dominance in the realm of iron and steel, despite the Brooklyn Bridge, the Horseshoe Curve, and other undeniable accomplishments of American engineers. This humiliation could not be allowed to stand. America's pride in its growing power and international stature had fanned patriotism to a new intensity. The nation needed an opportunity to top the French, in particular to out-Eiffel Eiffel. Suddenly, the idea of hosting a great exposition to commemorate Columbus's discovery of the New World became irresistible. At first, most people in America believed that if an exposition honoring the deepest roots of the nation were to be held anywhere, the site should be Washington, the nation's capital. Initially, even Chicago's editors agreed. As the notion of an exposition gained shape, however, other cities began to see it as a prize to be coveted, mainly for the stature it would confer. Stature being a powerful lure in this age when pride of place ranked second only to pride of blood. Suddenly, New York and St. Louis wanted the fair. Washington laid claim to the honor on grounds it was the center of government, New York because it was the center of everything. No one cared what St. Louis thought, although the city got a wink for pluck. Nowhere was civic pride more powerful than in Chicago, where men spoke of the Chicago spirit as if it were a tangible force, and prided themselves on the speed with which they had rebuilt the city after the Great Fire of 1871. They had not merely restored it, they had turned it into the nation's leader in commerce, manufacturing, and architecture. All the city's wealth, however, had failed to shake the widespread perception that Chicago was a secondary city that preferred butchered hogs to Beethoven. On June 29, 1889, Chicago's mayor, DeWitt C. Krieger, announced the appointment of a citizens' committee consisting of 250 of the city's most prominent men. The committee met and passed a resolution. Its closing passage read, "The men who have helped build Chicago want the fair, and having a just and well-sustained claim, they intend to have it." Congress had the final say, however, and now the time for the big vote had come. A Tribune clerk stepped to the window. He was tall, thin, and young, and wore a black beard. He looked at the crowd without expression. In one hand, he held a paste pot, in the other a brush and a bulletin sheet. He took his time. He set the bulletin on a table, out of sight, but everyone in the crowd could tell what he was doing by the motion of his shoulders. He took his time unscrewing the paste pot. There was something somber in his face, as if he were looking down upon a casket. Methodically, he painted paste onto the bulletin. It took him a good long while to raise it to the window. His expression did not change. He fastened the bulletin to the glass. Burnham waited. His office faced south, as did Roots, to satisfy their craving for natural light, a universal hunger throughout Chicago, where gas jets, still the primary source of artificial illumination, did little to pierce the city's perpetual coal smoke dusk. That he should be there now, a man of such exalted professional stature, in an office so high above the city, would have come as a great and satisfying surprise to his dead father. Daniel Hudson Burnham was born in Henderson, New York, on September 4, 1846, into a family devoted to Swedenborgian principles of obedience, self-subordination, and public service. In 1855, when he was 9, the family moved to Chicago, where his father established a successful wholesale drug business. Burnham was a lackluster student. He excelled, however, at drawing and sketched constantly. He was 18 when his father sent him east to study with private tutors to prepare him for the entrance exams for Harvard and Yale. The boy proved to have a severe case of test anxiety. "I went to Harvard for examination with two men not as well prepared as I," he said. "Both passed easily, and I flunked, having sat through two or three examinations without being able to write a word." The same happened at Yale. Both schools turned him down. He never forgot it. In the fall of 1867, at 21, he returned to Chicago. He sought work in a field where he might be successful and took a job as a draftsman with the architectural firm of Loring and Jenny. He had found his calling, he wrote in 1868, and told his parents he wanted to become the greatest architect in the city or country. The next year, however, he bolted for Nevada with friends to try his hand at mining gold. He failed. He ran for the Nevada legislature and failed again. He returned to Chicago broke in a cattle car and joined the firm of an architect named L.G. Lorien. Then came October 1871. A cow, a lantern, confusion, and wind. The great Chicago fire took nearly 18,000 buildings and left over 100,000 people homeless. The destruction promised endless work for the city's architects, but Burnham quit. He sold plate glass, failed. He became a druggist, quit. Exasperated and worried, Burnham's father in 1872 introduced his son to an architect named Peter White, who admired the young man's skill at drawing and hired him as a draftsman. Burnham was 25. He liked White and liked the work. He liked especially one of White's other draftsmen, a Southerner named John Wellborn Root, who was 4 years younger. Born in Lumpkin, Georgia on January 10, 1850, Root was a musical prodigy who could sing before he could talk. Burnham took to Root immediately. They became friends, then partners. They recorded their first income 3 months before the panic of 1873 snuffed the nation's economy. This time, Burnham stuck with it. Something about the partnership with Root bolstered him. It filled an absence and played to both men's strengths. They struggled for their own commissions and in the meantime hired themselves out to other, more established firms. One day in 1874, a man walked into their office and in a single galvanic moment changed their lives. He wore black, looked ordinary, but in his past there was blood, death, and profit in staggering quantity. He came looking for Root, but Root was out of town. He introduced himself instead to Burnham and gave his name as John B. Sherman. There was no need to amplify the introduction. As superintendent of the Union Stockyards, Sherman ruled an empire of blood that employed 25,000 men, women, and children, and each year slaughtered 14 million animals. Directly and indirectly, nearly one-fifth of Chicago's population depended on the yards for its economic survival. Sherman liked Burnham. He liked his strength, his steady blue gaze, and the confidence with which he conducted the conversation. Sherman commissioned the firm to build him a mansion on Prairie Avenue at 21st Street, among homes owned by other Chicago barons, and where now and then Marshall Field, George Pullman, and Philip Armour could be seen walking to work together, a titanic threesome in black. Root drew a house of three stories, with gables and a peaked roof, in red brick, buff sandstone, blue granite, and black slate. Burnham refined the drawings and guided construction. Burnham happened to be standing at the entrance to the house, considering the work, when a young man with a mildly haughty air and an odd strut, not ego here, but a congenital fault, walked up to him and introduced himself, giving his name as Lewis Sullivan. The name meant nothing to Burnham. Not yet. Sullivan and Burnham talked. Sullivan was 18, Burnham 28. He told Sullivan in confidence that he did not expect to remain satisfied doing just houses. "My idea," he said, "is to work up a big business, to handle big things, deal with big businessmen, and to build up a big organization. For you can't handle big things unless you have an organization." John Sherman's daughter Margaret also visited the construction site. She was young, pretty, and blonde, and visited often, using as her excuse the fact that her friend Della Otis lived across the street. Margaret did think the house very fine, but what she admired most was the architect, who seemed so at ease among the cairns of sandstone and timber. It took a while, but Burnham got the point. He asked her to marry him. She said yes. The courtship went smoothly. Then scandal broke. Burnham's older brother forged checks and wounded their father's wholesale drug business. Daniel immediately went to Margaret's father to break the engagement on grounds the courtship could not continue in the shadow of scandal. Sherman told him he respected Burnham's sense of honor, but rejected his withdrawal. He said quietly, "There is a black sheep in every family." Later, Sherman, a married man, would run off to Europe with the daughter of a friend. Burnham and Margaret married on January 20, 1876. Sherman bought them a house at 43rd Street and Michigan Avenue, near the lake, but more importantly, near the stockyards. He wanted proximity. He liked Burnham and approved of the marriage, but he did not entirely trust the young architect. He thought Burnham drank too much. Root also married a daughter of the stockyards. His experience was darker. He designed a house for John Walker, president of the yards, and met Walker's daughter Mary. During their courtship, she became ill with tuberculosis. The disease rapidly gained ground, but Root remained committed to the engagement, even though it was clear to everyone he was marrying a dead woman. Within 6 weeks after their wedding, Mary Walker Root was dead. 2 years later, Root married her bridesmaid, Dora Monroe. Root and Burnham prospered. A cascade of work flowed to their firm, partly because Root managed to solve a puzzle that had bedeviled Chicago builders ever since the city's founding. By solving it, he helped the city become the birthplace of skyscrapers despite terrain that could not have been less suited to the role. In the 1880s, Chicago experienced explosive growth that propelled land values to levels no one could have imagined, especially within the downtown loop, named for the turnaround loops of streetcar lines. As land values rose, land owners sought ways of improving the return on their investments. The sky beckoned. The most fundamental obstacle to height was man's capacity to walk stairs, especially after the kinds of meals men ate in the 19th century. But this obstacle had been removed by the advent of the elevator, and equally important, by Elisha Graves Otis's invention of a safety mechanism for halting an elevator in freefall. Other barriers remained, however, the most elemental of which was the bedeviling character of Chicago's soil, which prompted one engineer to describe the challenge of laying foundations in Chicago as probably not equal for perverseness anywhere in the world. Bedrock lay 125 feet below grade, too deep for workers to reach with any degree of economy or safety using the construction methods available in the 1880s. Between this and the surface was a mixture of sand and clay so saturated with water that engineers called it gumbo. It compressed under the weight of even modest structures and drove architects, as a matter of routine, to design their buildings with sidewalks that intersected the first story 4 inches above grade, in the hopes that when the building settled and dragged the sidewalks down with it, the walks would be level. There were only two known ways to resolve the soil problem: build short and avoid the issue, or drive caissons down to bedrock. The latter technique required that workers excavate deep shafts, shore the walls, and pump each so full of air that the resulting high pressure held water at bay, a process notorious for causing deadly cases of the bends and used mainly by bridge builders who had no other choice. But Chicago's landowners wanted profit, and at the city's center, profit meant height. In 1881, a Massachusetts investor, Peter Chardon Brooks III, commissioned Burnham and Root to build the tallest office building yet constructed in Chicago, which he planned to call the Montauk. The trickiest part of the Montauk was its foundation. Initially, Root planned to employ a technique that Chicago architects had used since 1873 to support buildings of ordinary stature. Workers would erect pyramids of stone on the basement slab. The broad bottom of each pyramid spread the load and reduced settlement. The narrow top supported load-bearing columns. To hold up 10 stories of stone and brick, however, the pyramids would have to be immense, the basement transformed into a Giza of stone. Brooks objected. He wanted the basement free for the boilers and dynamo. The solution, when Root first struck it, must have seemed too simple to be real. He envisioned digging down to the first reasonably firm layer of clay known as hardpan, and there spreading a pad of concrete nearly 2 feet thick. On top of this, workers would set down a layer of steel rails stretching from one end of the pad to the other, and over this a second layer at right angles. Succeeding layers would be arranged in the same way. Once complete, this grillage of steel would be filled and covered with Portland cement to produce a broad, rigid raft, which Root called a floating foundation. What he was proposing, in effect, was a stratum of artificial bedrock that would also serve as the floor of the basement. Brooks liked it. Once built, the Montauk was so novel, so tall, it defied description by conventional means. No one knows who coined the term, but it fit, and the Montauk became the first building to be called a skyscraper. What Chartres was to the Gothic cathedral, wrote Thomas Talmadge, a Chicago architect and critic, the Montauk block was to the high commercial building. Burnham and Root became rich men. Not Pullman rich, not rich enough to be counted among the first rank of society alongside Potter Palmer or Philip Armour, but rich beyond anything either man had expected. Enough so that each year Burnham bought a barrel of fine Madeira and aged it by shipping it twice around the world on slow freighters. As their firm prospered, the character of each partner began to emerge and clarify. Burnham was a talented artist and architect in his own right, but his great strength lay in his ability to win clients and execute the elegant designs of Root. Burnham was handsome, tall, and strong, with vivid blue eyes, all of which drew clients and friends to him the way a lens gathers light. Burnham understood that Root was the firm's artistic engine. He believed Root possessed a genius for envisioning a structure quickly in its entirety. When Burnham and Root were together, one woman said, I used to think of some big, strong tree with lightning playing around it. As their firm grew, so did the city. It got bigger, taller, richer, but it also grew dirtier, darker, and more dangerous. Chicago awed visitors and terrified them. French editor Octave Uzan called it that Gordian city, so excessive, so satanic. Success came easily to Burnham and Root, but the partners did have their trials. In 1885, a fire destroyed the Granis block, their flagship structure. At least one of them was in the office at the time and made his escape down a burning stairway. Another blow came in this period, but of a different character. Although Chicago was rapidly achieving recognition as an industrial and mercantile dynamo, its leading men felt keenly the slander from New York that their city had few cultural assets. To help address this lack, one prominent Chicagoan, Ferdinand W. Peck, proposed to build an auditorium so big, so acoustically perfect, as to silence all the carping from the East and make a profit to boot. Peck chose Chicago architect Dankmar Adler. If acoustically flawed, Peck knew the building would be a failure no matter how imposing the finished structure proved to be. Only Adler had previously demonstrated a clear grasp of the principles of acoustical design. Burnham was not pleased, wrote Lewis Sullivan, by now Adler's partner, nor was John Root precisely entranced. When Root saw early drawings of the auditorium, he said it appeared as if Sullivan was about to smear another facade with ornament. From the start, there was tension between the two firms, although for now it was subtle, a vibration, like the inaudible cry of overstressed steel. Outside the Tribune building, there was silence. The crowd needed a few moments to process the news. A man in a long beard was one of the first to react. He had sworn not to cut the beard until Chicago got the fare. Now he climbed the steps of the adjacent Union Trust Company bank. On the top step, he let out a shriek that one witness likened to the scream of a skyrocket. Others in the crowd echoed his cry, and soon 2,000 men and women and a few children, mostly telegraph boys and hired messengers, cut loose with a cheer that tore through the canyon of brick, stone, and glass like a flash flood. As soon as Chicago won the fair, it promptly established a formal corporation, the World's Columbian Exposition Company, to finance and build the fair. Quietly, officials made it clear that Burnham and Root would be the lead designers. The burden of restoring the nation's pride and prominence in the wake of the Paris Exposition had fallen upon Chicago, and Chicago, in turn, had lodged it firmly, if for now discreetly, on the top floor of the rookery. Failure was unthinkable. If the fair failed, Burnham knew, the nation's honor would be tarnished, Chicago humiliated, and his own firm dealt a crushing blow. Everywhere Burnham turned, there was someone, a friend, an editor, a fellow club member, telling him that the nation expected something tremendous out of this fair, and expected it in record time. The auditorium alone had taken nearly 3 years to build and driven Lewis Sullivan to the brink of physical collapse. Now Burnham and Root were being called upon to build what amounted to an entire city in about the same amount of time, not just any city, but one that would surpass the brilliance of the Paris Exposition. The fair also would have to make a profit. Among Chicago's leading men, profitability was a matter of personal and civic honor. By traditional architectural standards, the challenge seemed an impossible one. Alone, neither architect could do it, but together, Burnham believed, he and Root had the will and the interlocking powers of organization and design to succeed. One morning in August 1886, as the heat rose from the streets with the intensity of a child's fever, a man calling himself H.H. Holmes walked into one of Chicago's train stations. The air was stale and still, suffused with the scent of rotted peaches, horse excrement, and partially combusted Illinois anthracite. Half a dozen locomotives stood in the train yard, exhaling steam into the already yellow sky. Holmes acquired a ticket to a village called Englewood in the town of Lake, a municipality of 200,000 people that abutted what was then Chicago's southernmost boundary. The township encompassed the Union Stockyards and two large parks, Washington Park with lawns, gardens, and a popular racetrack, and Jackson Park, a desolate, undeveloped waste on the lakeshore. Despite the heat, Holmes looked fresh and crisp. As he moved through the station, the glances of young women fell around him like windblown petals. He walked with confidence and dressed well, conjuring an impression of wealth and achievement. He was 26 years old. His height was 5 feet 8 3/4 inches. He weighed only 155 pounds. He had dark hair and striking blue eyes, once likened to the eyes of a mesmerist. "The eyes are very big and wide open," a physician named John L. Capon later observed. "They are blue. Great murderers, like great men in other walks of activity, have blue eyes. Overall," Capon noted, "he is made on a very delicate mold." To women, as yet unaware of Holmes' private obsessions, it was an appealing delicacy. He broke prevailing rules of casual intimacy. He stood too close, stared too hard, touched too much and too long, and women adored him for it. He stepped from the train into the heart of Englewood and took a moment to survey his surroundings. He stood at the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. On the corner stood a shop, with a sign identifying it as E.S. Holton Drugs. Holmes entered the store, and there found an elderly woman named Mrs. Holden. He sensed vulnerability. Sensed it the way another man might capture the trace of a woman's perfume. He identified himself as a doctor and licensed pharmacist, and asked the woman if she needed assistance in her store. He spoke softly and smiled often, and held her in his frank blue gaze. He was good with conversation, and soon she revealed to him her deepest sorrow. Her husband, upstairs in their apartment, was dying of cancer. She confessed that managing the store while caring for him had become a great burden. Holmes listened with moist eyes. He touched her arm. He could ease her burden, he said. Not only that, he could turn the drugstore into a thriving establishment and conquer the competition up the block. His gaze was so clear and blue. She told him she would have to talk to her husband. She walked upstairs. The day was hot. Flies rested on the windowsill. Outside, yet another train rumbled through the intersection. Cinder and smoke, like soiled gauze, drifted past the window. She would talk to her husband, yes, but he was dying, and she was the one who now managed the store and bore its responsibilities, and she had come to a decision. Just thinking about the young doctor, seeing those kind blue eyes, gave her a feeling of contentment she had not experienced in a long while. Holmes had been to Chicago before, but only for brief visits. The city impressed him, he said later, which was surprising, because as a rule nothing impressed him. Nothing moved him. Events and people captured his attention the way moving objects caught the notice of an amphibian. First a machine-like registration of proximity, next a calculation of worth, last a decision to act or remain motionless. When he resolved at last to move to Chicago, he was still using his given name, Herman Webster Mudgett. As for most people, his initial sensory contact with Chicago had been the fantastic stink that lingered always in the vicinity of the Union Stockyards, a chinook of putrefaction and incinerated hair, an elemental odor, wrote Upton Sinclair, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual and strong. It is tempting to imagine that all the death and blood made Mudgett feel welcome. But more realistic to suppose, it merely conveyed a sense that here at last was a city that allowed a broader range of behavior than was tolerated in Gilmanton Academy, New Hampshire, the town in which he was born and where he drifted through childhood as a small, odd, and exceptionally bright boy, and where, as a consequence, in the cruel imaginations of his peers, he became prey. The memory of one episode stayed with him throughout his life. He was 5, wearing his first boy's suit, when his parents sent him off to begin his education at the village schoolhouse. I had daily to pass the office of one village doctor, the door of which was seldom, if ever, barred, he wrote in a later memoir, partly from its being associated in my mind as the source of all the nauseous mixtures that had been my childish terror, for this was before the day of children's medicines, and partly because of vague rumors I'd heard regarding its contents. This place was one of peculiar abhorrence to me. In those days, a doctor's office could indeed be a fearsome place. All doctors were, in a sense, amateurs. The best of them bought cadavers for cash, no questions asked, and preserved particularly interesting bits of diseased viscera in large, clear bottles. Skeletons hung in offices for easy anatomical reference. Some transcended function to become works of art so detailed, so precisely articulated, every bleached bone hitched to its neighbor with brass under a skull grinning with slap-shoulder bonhomie, that they appeared ready to race chattering down the street to catch the next grip car. 2 older children discovered Mudgett's fear, and one day captured him and dragged him, struggling and shrieking, into the doctor's office. Nor did they desist, Mudgett wrote, until I had been brought face to face with one of its grinning skeletons, which, with arms outstretched, seemed ready in its turn to seize me. It was a wicked and dangerous thing to do to a child of tender years and health, he wrote, but it proved an heroic method of treatment, destined ultimately to cure me of my fears and to inculcate in me first a strong feeling of curiosity and later a desire to learn, which resulted years afterwards in my adopting medicine as a profession. The incident probably did occur, but with a different choreography. More likely, the 2 older boys discovered their 5-year-old victim did not mind the excursion, that far from struggling and shrieking, he merely gazed at the skeleton with cool appreciation. When his eyes settled back on his captors, it was they who fled. Gilmanton was a small farming village in New Hampshire's Lake Country, sufficiently remote that its residents did not have access to a daily newspaper and rarely heard the shriek of train whistles. Mudgett had two siblings, a brother and a sister. His father, Levi, was a farmer, as was Levi's own father. Mudgett's parents were devout Methodists, whose response to even routine misbehavior relied heavily on the rod and prayer, followed by banishment to the attic in a day with neither speech nor food. His mother often insisted he pray with her in her room, then filled the air around him with trembly passion. By his own assessment, he was a mother's boy. He spent a good deal of time alone in his room reading Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe, and inventing things. He built a wind-powered mechanism that generated noise to scare birds from the family fields, and set out to create a perpetual motion machine. His only close friend was an older child named Tom, killed in a fall while the boys were playing in an abandoned house. At 16, Mudgett graduated school, and despite his age, took a job as a teacher, first in Gilmanton, and then in Alton, New Hampshire, where he met a young woman named Clara A. Lubbering. She had never encountered anyone quite like Mudgett. He was young, but poised, and had a knack for making her feel good even when she was inclined to feel otherwise. His great flaw was his persistent demand that she allow him to make love to her, not as a lover in formal courtship, but in that way that was supposed to come only after marriage. She held him off, but could not deny that Mudgett aroused within her an intensity of desire that colored her dreams. He was 18 when he asked her to elope. She agreed. They married July 4th, 1878, before a justice of the peace. At first, there was passion far beyond what the dour gossip of older women had led Clara to expect, but their relationship chilled rapidly. Mudgett left the house for long periods. Soon he was gone for days at a time. Finally, he was just gone. In the wedding registry of Alton, New Hampshire, they remained married, their contract a legal, if desiccated, thing. At 19, Mudgett went to college. Initially, he set his sights on Dartmouth, but changed his mind and went instead directly into medical school. He enrolled first in the medicine program at the University of Vermont in Burlington, but found the school too small, and after only 1 year moved to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, one of the West's leading scientific medical schools, noted for its emphasis on the controversial art of dissection. He enrolled on September 21st, 1882. He graduated in June 1884 with a lackluster record and set out to find some favorable location in which to launch a practice. To do so, he took a job as a traveler with a nursery company based in Portland, Maine. His route took him through towns he might otherwise never have encountered. Eventually, he came to Moores Forks, New York, where, according to the Chicago Tribune, the trustees of the Moores Forks grade school, impressed with Mudgett's gentlemanly manners, hired him as the school principal, a post he held until he at last opened a medical practice. Wherever he went, troubling things seemed to occur. In Moores Forks, there were rumors that a boy seen in his company had disappeared. Mudgett claimed the boy had returned to his own home in Massachusetts. No investigation took place. No one could imagine the charming Dr. Mudgett causing harm to anyone, let alone a child. Eventually, Mudgett ended up in Chicago. There, in July 1886, the year Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced his detective to the world, Mudgett registered his name as Holmes. He understood that powerful new forces were acting upon Chicago, causing a nearly miraculous expansion. The city was growing in all available directions, and where it abutted the lake, it grew skyward, sharply increasing the value of land within the loop. As the city's population swelled, demand for apartments turned into flat fever. When people could not find or afford apartments, they sought rooms in private homes or boarding houses, where typically the rent included meals. One of the fastest-growing suburbs was Englewood. Even a newcomer like Holmes could tell that Englewood was booming. Real estate advertisements were full of testimonials to its location and appreciating values. Englewood, in fact, had been growing quickly ever since the Great Fire of 1871. One resident recalled how immediately after the fire, there was such a rush for homes in Englewood, and the population increased so rapidly that it was impossible to keep up with it. It was here, in what Chicagoans called a streetcar suburb, that stockyard supervisors chose to settle, as did officials of companies headquartered in the skyscrapers of the Loop. They acquired big houses on streets named Harvard and Yale that were lined with elm, ash, sycamore, and linden, and posted with signs barring all but essential wagon traffic. They took trains and streetcars to work and congratulated themselves on living upwind of the stockyards. The pharmacist, Dr. Holton, did die. Holmes made his widow an offer. He would buy the store, and she could continue to reside in the second-floor apartment. He couched his offer in prose that made it seem as if he were proposing the purchase, not to benefit himself, but solely to free the grieving Mrs. Holton from the burden of work. He touched her arm as he spoke. After she signed the deed over to him, he stood and thanked her with tears in his eyes. He financed the purchase mainly with money he raised by mortgaging the store's fixtures and stock, agreeing to repay the loan at a rate of $100 a month, about $3,000 in 21st century value. He put up a new sign, H.H. Holmes Pharmacy. As word spread that a young, handsome, and apparently unmarried young doctor now stood behind the counter, an increasing number of single women in their 20s began to patronize the store. Long-time customers also liked the new proprietor, but they missed the comforting presence of Mrs. Holton. The Holtons had been there when their children were sick, had comforted them when these illnesses proved mortal. They knew Mrs. Holton had sold the place, but why had they not seen her around town? Holmes smiled and explained that she had decided to visit relatives in California, something she had long wanted to do, but could never find the time or money to accomplish, and certainly could not have done with her husband on his deathbed. As time wore on and the inquiries dwindled, Holmes modified the story a bit. Mrs. Holton, he explained, liked California so much, she had decided to settle there permanently. In the light blazing through the drugstore window, Holmes' eyes seemed bluer than ever. Nothing. There had been so much energy, so much bravado, but now, nothing. It was July 1890. Nearly 6 months since Congress had voted to give the World's Columbian Exposition to Chicago, but the 45 men on the exposition's board of directors still had not decided where within the city the fair should be built. At the time of the vote, with the city's pride at stake, all Chicago had sung with one voice. Now, however, each quarter of Chicago was insisting on a location within its own boundaries, and the squabbling had stymied the board. The Fair's Committee on Grounds and Buildings had asked Burnham quietly to evaluate a number of locations in the city. With equal discretion, the committee assured Burnham and Root that ultimately they would direct the design and construction of the fair. For Burnham, each lost moment was a theft from the already scanty fund of time allotted to build the exposition. The final fair bill, signed in April by President Benjamin Harrison, established a dedication day for October 12, 1892, to honor the moment 400 years earlier that Columbus first sighted the New World. The formal opening, however, would not occur until May 1, 1893, to give Chicago more time to prepare. Even so, Burnham knew, much of the fair would have to be done by the dedication. That left just 26 months. A friend of Burnham's, James Elworth, was one of the board's directors. He, too, was frustrated by the stalemate, so much so that on his own initiative, during a business trip to Maine in mid-July, he visited the Brookline, Massachusetts office of Frederick Law Olmsted to try and persuade him to come to Chicago and evaluate the sites under consideration and perhaps take on the task of designing the fair's landscape. Ellsworth hoped that Olmsted's opinion, backed by his reputation as the Wizard of Central Park, would help force a decision. He offered Olmsted a consulting fee of $1,000, equivalent to about $30,000 today. That the money was his own, and that he lacked official authority to hire Olmsted, were 2 points Ellsworth failed to disclose. Olmsted declined. He did not design fairs, he told Ellsworth. He doubted, moreover, that enough time remained for anyone to do the fair justice. To produce the kind of landscape effects Olmsted strived to create required not months, but years, even decades. I have all my life been considering distant effects and always sacrificing immediate success and applause to that of the future, he wrote. In laying out Central Park, we determined to think of no result to be realized in less than 40 years. Ellsworth insisted that what Chicago had in mind was something far grander than even the Paris Exposition. He described for Olmsted a vision of a dream city designed by America's greatest architects, and covering an expanse at least one-third larger than the Paris Fair. Ellsworth assured Olmsted that by agreeing to help, he would be joining his name to one of the greatest artistic adventures of the century. Relenting slightly, Olmsted said he would think about it and agreed to meet with Ellsworth 2 days later on Ellsworth's return from Maine. Olmsted did think about it and began to see the exposition as an opportunity to achieve something for which he had fought long and hard, but almost always with disappointing result. Throughout his career, he had struggled with little success to dispel the perception that landscape architecture was simply an ambitious sort of gardening, and to have his field recognized instead as a distinct branch of the fine arts, full sister to painting, sculpture, and brick-and-mortar architecture. What landscape architecture needed, Olmsted believed, was greater visibility, which in turn would bring greater credibility. The exposition could help, he realized, provided it did rise to the heights envisioned by Ellsworth. He had to weigh this benefit, however, against the near-term costs of signing on. His firm already had a full roster of work, and Olmsted himself had grown increasingly susceptible to illness. He was 68 years old, and partly lame from a decades-old carriage accident that had left one leg an inch shorter than the other. He was prone to lengthy bouts of depression. His teeth hurt. He had chronic insomnia and facial neuralgia. A mysterious roaring in his ears at times made it difficult for him to attend to a conversation. He was still full of creative steam, still constantly on the move, but overnight train journeys invariably laid him low. Even in his own bed, his nights often became sleepless horrors laced with toothache. But Ellsworth's vision was compelling. Olmsted talked it over with his sons, and with the newest member of the firm, Henry Sargent Codman, Harry, an intensely talented young landscape architect who quickly had become a trusted advisor and confidant. When Ellsworth returned, Olmsted told him he had changed his mind. He would join the venture. On Wednesday, August 6, 1890, 3 weeks after Ellsworth's Brookline visit, the exposition company telegraphed Olmsted, "When can you be here?" Olmsted and Codman arrived 3 days later on Saturday morning. Olmsted looked worn from his travels, but his eyes were large, warm, and bright. He wanted to start work immediately. Here at last, Burnham saw, was a man who understood the true cost of each lost minute. Burnham, of course, knew of Olmsted's achievements. Central Park in Manhattan, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, the grounds of Cornell and Yale, and scores of other projects. Olmsted had a reputation for brilliance and tireless devotion to his work, but also for an acerbic candor that emerged most predictably in the presence of men who failed to understand that what he sought to create were not flower beds and ornamental gardens, but expanses of scenery full of mystery, shadow, and sun-stippled ground. Olmsted, for his part, knew that Burnham had been a leading force in driving buildings into the clouds. Burnham was said to be the business genius of his firm, Root the Artist. It was with Burnham that Olmsted felt the greatest kinship. Burnham was decisive, blunt, cordial, and spoke under a level blue gaze that Olmsted found reassuring. The tour began at once, but it was hardly an objective one. Burnham and Root clearly favored one location in particular, Jackson Park, on Chicago's south side, due east of Englewood on the lakeshore. As it happens, Olmsted knew this ground. 20 years earlier, at the request of Chicago's South Park commissioners, Olmsted had studied both Jackson Park and to its west, Washington Park, and the broad boulevard that connected them called Midway. In the plans he had produced for the commissioners, he envisioned transforming Jackson Park from a desert of sand and stagnant pools into a park unlike any other in the nation, focused on water and boating, with canals, lagoons, and shady coves. Olmsted finished those plans shortly before the Great Fire of 1871. In the rush to rebuild, Chicago never got around to realizing his vision. The park became part of Chicago during the 1889 annexations, but otherwise Olmsted saw little had changed. He knew its flaws, its many flaws, but believed that with a lot of deft dredging and sculpting, the park could be transformed into a landscape unlike any that ever seated an exposition. For he recognized that Jackson Park had something no other city in the world could equal. The spreading blue plain of Lake Michigan, as comely a backdrop for a fair as anyone could hope for. On Tuesday, August 12th, just 4 days after he and Codman arrived in Chicago, Olmsted filed a report with the exposition directors, who then, to Olmsted's chagrin, made the report public. Olmsted had intended the report for a professional audience, one that would take for granted Jackson Park's fundamental acceptability and value the report as an unflinching guide to the challenges ahead. He was surprised to find the report put to use by opposing cliques as evidence that the fair could not possibly be placed in Jackson Park. The directors asked for a second report. Olmsted delivered it on Monday, August 18th, 6 days after the first. It said in part, "What the many factions in the battle for the fair seemed to ignore was that Chicago had but one natural object at all distinctively local which can be regarded as an object of much grandeur, beauty, or interest. This is the lake." Burnham hoped this second report would at last compel a decision. The delay was maddening, absurd. The hourglass long ago upended. The board seemed unaware that Chicago now risked becoming a national, even global, embarrassment. Weeks passed. By the end of October 1890, the site question remained unresolved. Burnham and Root tended to their fast-growing practice. Contractors had begun erecting two of the firm's newest, tallest Chicago skyscrapers, the Woman's Christian Temperance Union Temple and the Masonic Fraternity Temple, at 21 stories, the tallest building in the world. The foundations of both were nearly finished and awaiting the installation of cornerstones. With architecture and construction such a fascination in Chicago, cornerstone ceremonies became extravagant affairs. The temperance celebration took place at the corner of LaSalle and Monroe, beside a 10-ton boulder of dark New Hampshire granite, 7 feet square by 3 feet thick. Here Burnham and Root joined other dignitaries, including Mrs. Frances E. Willard, president of the union, and Carter Henry Harrison, a former mayor who, with 4 earlier terms already under his belt, was again running for the office. When Harrison appeared, wearing his usual black slouch hat, his pocket quilled with cigars, the crowd roared a welcome, especially the Irish and union men, who saw Harrison as a friend of the city's lower classes. The presence of Harrison beside the temperance stone was more than a bit ironic. As mayor, Harrison had kept a couple of cases of fine bourbon in his office at City Hall. Nearby at the distribution warehouse of the Chicago Inter-Ocean, a widely read and respected newspaper, a young Irish immigrant and staunch supporter of Carter Harrison completed his workday. His name was Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast. He ran a squad of obstreperous newsboys whom he loathed, and who loathed him in return, as was clear by their taunts and practical jokes. That Prendergast might one day shape the destiny of the world's Columbian Exposition would have seemed ridiculous to these boys, for Prendergast to them was about as hapless and sorry a human being as they could imagine. He was 22 years old, born in Ireland in 1868. His family emigrated to the United States in 1871, and in August that year moved to Chicago, just in time to experience the Great Fire. He was always, as his mother said, a shy and retiring kind of a boy. When he was 13, his father died, and he lost his only friend. For a time, his withdrawal from the world seemed complete. He awakened slowly. He began reading books about law and politics, and to attend meetings of the Single Tax Club, which embraced Henry George's belief that private landowners should pay a tax, essentially rent, to reflect the underlying truth that land belonged to everyone. At these meetings, Prendergast insisted on taking part in every conversation, and once had to be carried from the room. To his mother, he seemed to be a different man, well-read, animated, involved. She said, "He got smart all of a sudden." In fact, his madness had become more profound. When he was not working, he wrote postcards, scores of them, perhaps hundreds, to the most powerful men in the city, in a voice that presumed he was their equal in social stature. He wrote to his beloved Harrison, and to assorted other politicians, including the governor of Illinois. It's possible even Burnham received a card, given his new prominence. That Prendergast was a troubled young man was clear. That he might be dangerous seemed impossible. To anyone who met him, he appeared to be just another poor soul crushed by the din and filth of Chicago. But Prendergast had grand hopes for the future, all of which rested on one man, Carter Henry Harrison. He threw himself eagerly into Harrison's campaign, albeit without Harrison's knowledge, sending postcards by the dozens and telling anyone who would listen that Harrison, staunch friend of the Irish and the working man, was the best candidate for the job. He believed that when Harrison at last won his fifth two-year term, ideally in the upcoming April 1891 election, but perhaps not until the next in 1893, he would reward Prendergast with a job. That was how Chicago politics worked. He had no doubt that Harrison would come through and rescue him from the frozen mornings and venomous newsboys that for the moment defined his life. Among the most progressive alienists, this kind of unfounded belief was known as a delusion, associated with a newly identified disorder called paranoia. Happily, most delusions were harmless. On October 25, 1890, the site for the fair still unchosen, worrisome news arrived from Europe. The first hint of forces gathering that could do infinitely more damage to the fair than the director's stalemate. The Chicago Tribune reported that increasing turbulence in global markets had raised concerns in London that a recession, even a full-blown panic, could be in the offing. Immediately, these concerns began buffeting Wall Street. Railroad stocks tumbled. The value of Western Union's shares fell by 5%. In the midst of this intensifying financial turbulence, on October 30th, the Exposition Board appointed Burnham chief of construction with a salary equivalent to $360,000. Burnham, in turn, made Root the fair's supervising architect and Olmsted its supervising landscape architect. Burnham now possessed formal authority to begin building a fair, but still had no place to put it. By the end of 1886, Holmes Pharmacy was running smoothly and profitably. His thoughts turned now to a woman he had met earlier in the year during his brief stay in Minneapolis, Myrta Z. Belknap. She was young and blonde, with blue eyes and a lush figure, but what elevated her above mere beauty was the aura of vulnerability and need that surrounded her. She became an immediate obsession, her image and need locked in his brain. He traveled to Minneapolis, ostensibly on business. He had no doubt that he would succeed. It amused him that women as a class were so wonderfully vulnerable, as if they believed the codes of conduct that applied in their safe little hometowns, like Alva, Clinton, and Percy, might actually still apply once they had set out on their own and left their dusty, kerosene-scented parlors behind. The city toughened them quickly, however. Best to catch them at the start of their ascent toward freedom, in transit from small places, when they were anonymous, lost, their presence recorded nowhere. Every day he saw them stepping from trains and grip cars and hansom cabs, inevitably frowning at some piece of paper that was supposed to tell them where they belonged. The city's madams understood this and were known to meet inbound trains with promises of warmth and friendship, saving the important news for later. Holmes adored Chicago, adored in particular how the smoke and din could envelop a woman and leave no hint that she ever had existed, save perhaps a blade-thin track of perfume amid the stench of dung, anthracite, and putrefaction. To Myrta, Holmes seemed to have stepped from a world far more exciting than her own. She lived with her parents and clerked in a music store. Minneapolis was small, somnolent, and full of Swedish and Norwegian farmers as charming as cornstalks. Holmes was handsome, warm, and obviously wealthy, and he lived in Chicago, the most feared and magnetic of cities. Even during their first meeting, he touched her. His eyes deposited a bright blue hope. When he left the store that first day, as motes of dust filled the space he left behind, her own life seemed drab beyond endurance. A clock ticked. Something had to change. When his first letter arrived, asking sweetly if he might court her, she felt as if a coarse blanket had been lifted from her life. Every few weeks he returned to Minneapolis. When he asked her to be his wife, she accepted immediately. They married on January 28, 1887. Holmes neglected to tell Myrta that he already had a wife, Clara Lovering, the original Mrs. Herman Webster Mudgett. 2 weeks after marrying Myrta, he filed a petition in the Supreme Court of Cook County, Illinois, to divorce Lovering. This was no fine-spirited gesture to clear the record. He charged Lovering with infidelity, a ruinous accusation. He allowed the petition to lapse, however, and eventually the court dismissed it for failure to prosecute. In Chicago, Murta and Holmes settled into the second-floor apartment previously occupied by Mrs. Holton. By the spring of 1888, Murta was pregnant. At first, she helped run the drugstore. She liked working with her husband and often watched him when he was engaged with a customer. She savored his looks and blue calm and craved the moments when in the course of routine tasks their bodies would touch. She admired, too, the charm with which he managed each transaction and how he won the business even of elderly customers loyal to the absent Mrs. Holton. And she smiled, at least initially, as each in a seemingly endless train of young women entered the store insisting that only direct consultation with Dr. Holmes himself would suffice. But soon Murta tired of all those young female customers and the way Holmes would smile at them and touch them and channel his blue gaze into their eyes. Her increasing possessiveness did not anger Holmes. Rather, he came to see her as an obstacle, just as a sea captain might view an iceberg, something to monitor and avoid. Business was so good, he told Murta, that he needed her help managing the store's books. She found herself spending more and more time in an office upstairs, writing correspondence and preparing invoices for the drugstore. She wrote to her parents of her sorrow. In the summer of 1888, her parents moved to Wilmette, Illinois, where they occupied a pretty two-story house on John Street opposite a church. Lonely, sad, and pregnant, Murta joined them at the house and there bore a daughter, Lucy.